Today, it's about the numbers, skyrocketing U.S. foreclosure numbers. Days, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf has left to rule. The number of Latinos, Asians, and African Americans in America, and new Olympic swimming records. The numbers, they add up in many ways. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, August 15th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora. In this hour, we look toward the future, from the next leader in Pakistan to the next Michael Phelps, from the coming minority majority to a new version of the American dream, plus the staggering rate of foreclosures in American cities. That's all coming up this hour, but first, these headlines.
U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in the Republic of Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, with a ceasefire proposal for Georgia and Russia. She says even though it lets some Russian troops stay in Georgia, this new agreement is in Georgia's best interest. The agreement comes even as Russian troops are reportedly controlling two key Georgian cities. A controversial deal between the U.S. and Poland may make U.S.-Russian relations even worse. The deal allows the U.S. to put a missile defense system in Poland. A Russian general says the move won't go, quote, unpunished, but he didn't give specifics.
As India celebrates 61 years of independence today, the prime minister says the peace process with Pakistan is in danger of failing, in part because of Pakistan's rumored involvement in last month's bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. Pakistan's intelligence service is said to be supporting pro-Taliban militants in tribal areas. Meanwhile, Pakistan is facing its own instability. President Pervez Musharraf may resign in the next few days rather than face impeachment. Three of Pakistan's four assemblies have called on Musharraf to step down.
Michael Phelps has racked up his sixth gold medal in Beijing, but Phelps, well, Catherine, that's just not good enough for him.
Huh?
My goal of raising the bar in the sport of swimming, I think, is coming along nicely, but, I think it's still going to take time for me to really get it to where I want it to be.
Phelps is one gold medal away from tying Mark Spitz's record of seven. American Airlines is facing $7 million in fines. That's after the FAA found that American flew planes it knew needed repairs and didn't properly test employees for drugs and alcohol.
Oil's prices dipped to below $114 a barrel in Asian trading, and the Dow was up almost 1%. It closed at 11,615. The S&P up just slightly, opening at 1285.
America's changing. We've been talking about that this week because of the U.S. Census Bureau numbers. And we want to know, what are you seeing in your neighborhood? What does your neighborhood look like? Who's moving in? Who's moving out? What do your schools look like? Your workplace? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Do you believe that by 2042, minorities will become the new majority? We'd like to hear from you.
And, of course, what does that even mean? And we'd like to know what that means to you. So go ahead, give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. And then, of course, Adora and I will just sit here and count up the new Michael Phelps records.
Right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Hey there, Catherine.
Good morning.
And we're going to begin with the crisis in between Russia and the Republic of Georgia. Much attention today is focused on the diplomatic moves by the U.S., German, and Russian officials. Meanwhile, Russia is continuing to consolidate positions inside Georgia, at least according to reports, again conflicting today. The separatist region of South Ossetia is under full Russian control, where Moscow appears to be moving to make its presence permanent. Joining us live on the line is Stephen Eek, a Russian affairs analyst with our partner, the BBC. Welcome, Stephen.
Good morning. Thank you for the introduction. Well, as you've mentioned, there are two distinct events taking place today. The first one is on the diplomatic front. The American Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is in Georgia, and she says she's there to show support for its beleaguered president, Mikhail Saakashvili. Now, she's already said she wants to clarify certain points of the peace plan that was put forward by France earlier in the week, but that first and foremost she wants to see the American troops leaving Georgia. She has again called for it.
You mean Russian troops?
Russian troops out of Georgia. Sorry about that. I've been speaking about this one for 8 days now.
Yes. We just want to be clear. We don't want to alarm anyone. American troops have not headed in.
Not American troops. Sorry, Russian troops out of Georgia. Let's get that one. Absolutely right. On the other hand, we have the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, who's in Sochi, where the Winter Olympics will be held in 2014. And she's talking to Dmitry Medvedev, the Russian president, and apparently trying to calm him down and to call on Russia to be less confrontational in its approach. There is, of course, despite those diplomatic initiatives, another factor now hanging around in the background, which is that the deal that was signed yesterday between the United States and Poland over the proposed missile defense system for Central Europe, that is seriously aggravating Moscow. They're saying it's aimed against Russia and won't do anything to help resolve the current conflict. There is the second element of the whole story, of course, is what the Russians are doing inside Georgia. And of particular interest is what they're up to in the main port of Georgia, which is a place called Poti.
Stephen, did we lose you?
No, I'm just carrying on. In Poti, which is quite close to Abkhazia, the other separatist region we've been talking about, it does appear that the Russians have systematically decided to destroy the naval infrastructure that exists there. It's been reported that they've actually sunk a number of ships and they've confiscated weaponry. Now, the Russians have held a press conference in which they've said they are moving, confirmed they are moving to degrade the Georgian military infrastructure. If you remember over the last week, what they've actually done, they've taken out military radars, runways, removed a lot of weaponry, and now also destroyed Georgia's naval capacity in the port of Poti.
And Stephen, we've seen reported that destruction also includes Georgia's communication system, or at least that in relationship to South Ossetia.
Yes, it's interesting how the Russians have moved now in South Ossetia itself, this region that they're in complete control of. They have moved in the information war and the propaganda war, which is an important element in this whole story. They've moved to actually bring that region very much under Russian influence and Russian control in as far as the media and electronic means of communication are concerned. Russians are saying they are going to establish a mobile telephone network there that will be connected with Russia, not with Georgia. They are reported to have moved mobile television antenna there to start broadcasting Russian television, which is an important part in this whole propaganda war, so that people won't have access to Georgian television. They are also saying they're opening a branch of the Russian Savings Bank, which is a state bank, to start distributing aid payments to the local population. So Russia is moving both militarily, politically, and in the propaganda war to assert its control of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. No word yet on what they're going to do in terms of actually assimilating them or whether they're going to try to turn them into some kind of internationally recognized independent republics. But in terms of the situation on the ground, they're very much in control.
And very evolving story. Stephen Eek, thank you for that update. Stephen Eek, Russian affairs analyst with the BBC. Catherine?
Adora, one in over 460 households in this country has received a foreclosure filing in July, according to the Associated Press. That's a jump of more than 50% compared with July from last year. Here are some more numbers. More than 270,000 homes received foreclosure notices in July alone this year. Now, despite some funding that was backed by Congress and the White House to help homeowners, the number is going to move up. Some 2.8 million households are going to foreclose or lose their homes to lenders by the end of this year. This is a problem that can hit a city hard. In Miami, for instance, one in every 62 homes is in foreclosure. Miami Mayor Manny Diaz is overseeing this problem. He's also the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and he's been hearing about this from colleagues all over the country. Thanks for joining us, Mayor. Can you give us an idea of how this foreclosure situation is striking Miami?
Well, obviously, from an operational point of view, the city's tax base has decreased. We're looking at the numbers of this year. We've had a pretty consistent double-digit growth over the last few years, and this year we're down to somewhere in the single digits, probably around 5%, which is still not bad, but certainly not where we were just a couple of years ago.
Now, you were part of an effort to get federal legislation that the White House did sign, offering some relief to homeowners, but how far is this going to go?
Well, it's going to help some. I mean, the estimates that we get from Washington, it's about 400,000. So it's
400,000 homes?
400,000 families, yes. Okay. I mean, not the full amount, not the extent of the problem as you described it, but at least it's something, and it's going to be targeted primarily to those areas that are having the highest rates of foreclosure. So you're looking at South Florida, you're looking at Southern California, and perhaps Nevada and other places that experienced tremendous growth and now are seeing really what in many respects is a market adjustment.
You know, you called it a market adjustment, and obviously, as I recall, Las Vegas, Nevada, that is one. I think that is the hardest hit state, and you can, as you say, directly trace that to where there was a boom. Now there is a bust. But let's go back to how this affects a city's books. I mean, blocks of empty homes, no property taxes. How do you prepare for the future?
Well, we're going to have to obviously, from the government perspective, we have to tighten up. We're not going to have the revenues that we've been accustomed to over the last few years. We've got tax forces that are working with many of the families that are going through foreclosure. We also have several departments that are working on identifying foreclosed homes, dealing with the attendant problems that it brings to neighborhoods, as you pointed out.
And let's Mayor, let me interrupt you there, because let's talk about some of the attendant problems. Beyond the numbers, what does this do to the everyday quality of life? What kinds of problems are you facing now that you believe are directly related to this explosion of foreclosures?
Well, I mean, clearly what happens is that you have people that are trespassed, that are not welcome, that are going into some of these abandoned homes. In some cases, they're even living in them now, or otherwise they're going in and stealing appliances or stealing other things. So obviously, crime is a factor. Drugs. I mean, some of them may become crack houses or other drug havens. So I mean, it's an issue. Some may be subject to arson. So clearly, and then just the impact on the neighborhood. I mean, the rest of the families that are living on that block that are not experiencing a foreclosure problem see their property values and the investment that they've made all of a sudden become less valuable. So it's a significant impact, and that's why it was so important in the legislation that there was a piece in there that the president was adamantly opposed to and then finally agreed to, which is a piece that provides the funding for local local governments to allow us to, in some cases, demolish. It gives us a whole array, a menu of items that we can use, including foreclosure, including providing soft second mortgages for homeowners so that they don't lose their home, and other financing options. So it was a very important part in order for local government to try to stabilize neighborhoods.
Very quickly, how long do you think before we get any sense of recovery?
You know, in the single family area, I really don't expect this to go much longer. I think that the sellers are going to become much more realistic in terms of the pricing that they're asking for. Believe it or not, some people still have an unrealistic view of the value of their home.
Well, that's certainly understandable. Mayor, we're going to have to let you go, but I want to thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Pleasure being with you this morning.
And that is Miami Mayor Manny Diaz. I want to thank him again. He's the president of the United States Conference of Mayors. We're talking about your changing neighborhood, so let us know more. Go to mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us 877-8-MYTAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. President Bush just got done speaking in the Rose Garden at the White House, asserting that the Cold War is over, demanding that Russia get out of Georgia. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, of course, is in Georgia, and we will be bringing you a speech she's expected to make in Tbilisi later this morning. Adora?
And we're going to talk about Pakistan right now and some of the turbulence in the political landscape that's taking place there. It appears Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf is in a free fall. Already three of Pakistan's four provincial parliaments have declared him unfit for office. Now, that's entirely symbolic. However, those notices have been followed by a loss in confidence, it seems, by the country's powerful military and his key U.S. allies. Reports today suggest Musharraf will step down in the next 72 hours rather than face impeachment proceedings, which were scheduled for next week. Christine Fair, a senior political scientist at RAND, has been following all the events. She joins us now. Good morning, Christine. If Musharraf goes, what an earth-shattering change in Pakistan politics.
Well, you know, it's earth-shattering here, but it's not terribly earth-shattering there. Since Musharraf took his uniform off in November, he's actually been powerless. It's been an important change that most people in Washington have certainly been slow to appreciate. And certainly within the Pakistani context, he has been loathed and despised probably from 2006 onward, if not sooner. I was actually somewhat hopeful. I shouldn't say I was hopeful. I had no illusions that he would be impeached. Impeaching him would mean, once the process begins, essentially impeaching the army. And this would not be an outcome palatable to the army. But had the impeachment actually gone forward, though it would have been a low probability event, that really would have been momentous because it would have been a condemnation of the army's insistence upon its right to intervene in the civilian political setup when things aren't going as they think they should be going.
And not only that, Christine, it would have really been a bit of chaos, wouldn't it? Because you're talking about right now the ruling coalition is a new ruling coalition, not even 6 months old. It's fragile. It's at a time when the country's economy is very weak, and you have many issues with the Northwest Territories. Given all of that, if Musharraf does go, or when he does go, who takes over?
Well, going back to your point about would there be chaos, or even more chaos if there was impeachment, there's already chaos. The problem is, as you noted, is that the two parties that are in a coalition have never been in a coalition before. In fact, they're sworn enemies, all things considered. And oddly enough, it's Musharraf that's kind of been the bondo keeping this jalopy on the road. So the question is whether Musharraf, you know, goes or how he goes. There's a real set of questions about the viability of this coalition. As long as Musharraf was there, the president seat was already occupied. Now that Musharraf is going to go, we're very likely to see Zardari, who is Benazir Bhutto's widow, trying to vie to take over that position of president. President Musharraf, like every other military dictator before him, put into place a series of constitutional amendments that gave him the right to dismiss the government. It's very controversial, but it remains. They've been unable to strip that power from the president, despite the elections. So I would imagine that Nawaz Sharif would feel very uncomfortable with Zardari becoming president, which is, by all accounts, is what he wants to do. By the Constitution, the Speaker of the Senate will replace Musharraf as the president, and that fellow Sumro. He's, you know, neither here nor there. He's not terribly politically relevant. and everyone would understand that.
More of a bureaucrat, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, most of these politicians aren't really politicians in the sense that we think of them. I was in Quetta in April, and a politician said to me, you know, I actually have no interest in legislating. And my only question to her was, and why are you sitting in the provincial assembly? Couldn't you find another job, you know, more similar to your interests rather than legislating?
It really points to all of the complexities of Pakistan politics, which we could go on endlessly about. But let's move and chat a bit about this uncharted territory that the U.S. now finds itself in terms of Pakistan policy. What calculations do you think the U.S. government is making right now, given how important Pakistan is to the war on terror?
Well, I think people here in Washington have really seen this impeachment issue as a distraction. I actually don't agree with that. This is fundamentally about who is going to govern Pakistan. If we really believe in democracy, then we have to support a process that brings the military under greater civilian control. My view is that this process of impeachment would have been a huge step in that direction, which, by the way, is why the army never would have let this go forward. That would have been the biggest impediment. So fundamentally, the questions about this Musharraf presidency really are at the heart of democratic questions in Pakistan. You know, his second election was extra-constitutional. And to preempt the Supreme Court from saying as much, he simply, you know, ousted justices that were opposed to him.
But what does it do to the U.S. need for the military to help in the Northwest provinces and along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, given the rise of the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the last several months? How does it impact what the U.S. is trying to accomplish there?
Well, see, again, this is where the U.S. kind of doesn't really understand where its allies really lie. So the problem with the military is that the military has decided, not the civilians, that it is not in their interest to continue prosecuting counterinsurgency operations. And the reasons for this are numerous. The first being that they really weren't good at it. They have been repeatedly and decisively defeated in military confrontations with the militants. They are not a counterinsurgency army. They're a huge conventional army raised to really fight Indians on the plains of the Punjab. And they have had, if Americans think that our military has had problems becoming capable in counterinsurgency, they have absolutely no ability to appreciate how horrible and how difficult it's been for the Pakistan army.
Horrible and difficult for the Pakistan army, not to mention Pervez Musharraf. Christine Fair, thank you. Christine is a senior political scientist at RAND and an expert in South Asian and military affairs. And now we're going to go to Femi Okeh with a few headlines this hour.
Hello there. It is 29 minutes past the hour. All the main stories are around Georgia and also Russia and the United States. President Bush has just finished speaking at the White House. In his address, he forcefully aligned the U.S. with the Republic of Georgia. The president also demands that Russia get out of Georgia and says the people there have cast their lot with the free world, and I quote, "We will not cast them aside." Meanwhile, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is talking up a new ceasefire plan for Russia and the Republic of Georgia. She says the deal is in Georgia's best interests. Russia is stepping up a war of words over a controversial deal between the U.S. and Poland that will allow the U.S. to put a missile defense system on Polish soil. A top Russian general says Poland is opening up itself to the possibility of attack if it allows the deal to go through. That's a wrap for your main headlines.
Many thanks.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We are following developments in the conflict between Russia and the Republic of Georgia. President Bush just spoke moments ago in the Rose Garden at the White House. And we are expecting any moment, for Condoleezza Rice, who is currently in Georgia, to speak. Meanwhile, more diplomacy, intense diplomacy happening as the Chancellor of Germany is meeting with Vladimir Putin, the President of Russia. So clearly some developments to come on that. And Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry.
Thank you. I think she's meeting with President Medvedev. Of Russia, not Putin, but we'll double check on that. John Zogby is a maverick political pollster, Adora. You've heard of him. He's made some uncanny successful calls. In his new book, he's taking a look at an even bigger canvas, the American dream in transition. He's populated this new world with four distinct archetypes, a first global, a Nike generation, a private, a Woodstock. Those are your choices. We're going to find out what these tags mean and what Zogby thinks they say about the future as he talks to us about the way we'll be, the Zogby Report on the transformation of the American dream. Hey, John Zogby, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, good morning. What a pleasure.
Now, we're in an economic downturn. The foreclosure rate is staggering, and we're at war, but you see a rosy future?
Oh, I do indeed. You know, these are boom and bust periods, but the important thing is that in the recent recessions that we have had, where people have been dealt a lot of lemons, over the years they've learned how to make lemonade. And so there have been some serious adjustments that we have made as Americans to our lives, not the least of which is the fact that on one end of the spectrum, better than one in four of us work at a job that pays less than a previous job. And so we've been forced to move, I guess, as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross might suggest,
oh, <no. laughs>
from anger to all the way to adjustment.
I believe there's denial, then there's, you know, acceptance.
And acquiescence and all the way. We are adjusting. On the other end of the spectrum, you have those who've done very, very well, by all accounts, materially, but who have concluded for one reason or another that, hey, you know, there's got to be more to my life than this chase. And then in between, and this is where I get somewhat into generational kinds of issues, you have so many Americans who realize that at the age of 60 or 65, they may have 25 to 35 years of good health remaining in their lives, and they really want to do something that is fulfilling, something that defines their life beyond what they did for work.
You came up with four specific populations. If we could briefly go through them, and maybe we should start with the first globals, because they seem to be getting a lot of your attention. Who are the first globals?
18 to 29-year-olds who have passports. When I wrote this book almost a year ago, 42% of this age group had passports. It's well over 50%. They travel overseas, but they have the internet available to them, global music, global fashion. They have the first global perspective of any age cohort. They are very much citizens of the planet before they're citizens of the United States.
All right. And then who would their parents be?
In many instances, boomers, but older Generation Xers. I call Generation Xers the Nike generation. This was the first group of people not wedded because of circumstances to many traditional institutions. They were born into broken marriages. They were born into Watergate. They were born into a world of scandal and of institutions that were falling apart. And so their motto as libertarians with a small L, just do it. And so I call them the Nikes.
Okay, any discussion of the American dream, any discussion of the American population, if I hear the phrase baby boomer one more time, I'm going to explode.
So don't. I've renamed them.
Oh, good.
The Woodstockers, and I'm one of them myself. And literally, I was at Woodstock and really hated every moment that I was there. The music was wonderful. But my fellow Americans who were there were disgusting. And it's
there. You got to be at an iconic event and you're going to complain to me about hygiene or something?
Yeah. Oh, it was disgusting. In a word. You know, I think solipsism is a good word for early morning NPR radio, but the truth is.
Wait a minute! Ding, 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 ding! The vocabulary sweepstakes. You just won, John Zogby.
Oh, great! The duck came down. We are a generation of which too much was made out of us, and we learn to absorb that.
Everyone's going to agree with that quickly in the time we have remaining. You also have a fourth population that you call the private.
The private generation, yes, sandwiched in between Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation and the Woodstockers. These are people who, sense of duty, sense of community, sense of honor, old-fashioned patriotism. So you see where there's some real tension here, interesting tension among the four different groups I talk about.
All right. Now, we know that you've shied away from the candidates in this book, and it seems pretty clear that the McCain campaign is a private. Obama represents the first global. So how are you going to frame this election, and how do your populations help shape what's coming up in the campaign?
Well, for starters, you have representatives of two distinct generations, but also means two distinct paths for the United States of America. On one hand, it can choose the path of globalism, of diversity, of multiculturalism, of America no longer a unipolar power, but a cooperative power with other nations, versus an older America with a sense of duty and honor, and heroism, and my way or the highway.
Okay, John, we're going to ask you to stick there. I want you to stick around because later in the show, we're going to talk more about these new census numbers. And John is going to join us for that conversation. A reminder, John Zogby is the author of The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And now we are going to make a transition over to news headlines. And Femi, okay. Hey.
Thanks, Catherine. 20 minutes to the hour. President Bush has just spoken briefly at the White House. He made a strong commitment to standing by and supporting the former Soviet state of Georgia.
The United States and our allies stand with the people of Georgia and their democratically elected government.
The president also said that the Cold War is over and that a contentious relationship with the United States is not in Russia's interests. Just coming over the Associated Press newswires, Russia's president says that Georgia's breakaway regions, and I quote, are unlikely to live together with Georgia. Meanwhile, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is in Georgia. She's expected to speak shortly, and she's urging the Georgians to accept a new peace plan with Russia. The U.S. and Poland have agreed to put a U.S. missile defense system on Polish soil, and that plan is drawing sharp rebukes from the Kremlin. I have a lot more news for you, but I will bring that to you later.
Thanks Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and swimmer Mike Phelps is up to 6 gold medals with 6 new world records in Beijing. His latest win came in the 200-meter individual medley. Next up is the 100-meter butterfly final. Now, of course, there's been a tremendous amount of excitement and coverage of what's been happening there in China. But there's also a big story about what's happening here, which is lots of young people, children, young adults, have been inspired by watching the U.S. swim team and the 2008 Olympics. And perhaps that's going to be the next generation. You could call it the Phelps effect. And joining us, we have 2 Olympic swimming fans, Tamika Lewis and Kayra Lenore. They're from Mount Vernon, and they swim at the YMCA pool, right?
Yeah.
Ladies?
Yeah.
What do you like about swimming?
Well, I think it's very interesting.
Tamika, interesting because why?
Because you'll be soon as you keep practicing, you'll be one day, you'll be an excellent swimmer, and you'll be able to go on an Olympics team.
You want to be on an Olympics team? What about you, Kayra?
I just love swimming because it's a good sport, and I'm just trying to do my backstroke.
Just trying to do your backstroke. So you're watching them at the Olympics. What do you think about those Olympic swimmers?
I think that I will always try to do it, and I'll always try to go in the Olympics.
You want to go to the Olympics now?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I love to swim. You like it.
What do you guys think about the swimmers that you've been seeing at the Olympics, Tamika?
Well, they have speed limits, and some win first place, third place, and second place, because I like how fast they swim and how they do it, how they do the moves and how they do the butterfly and everything. So I would like to beat them one day.
You'd like to beat them one day. Well, there you go. That's what I call ambition. We have swim coach Offit Porter, who's here, who teaches these young ladies swimming. So they're all revved up. Have your students been watching, like, every single frame of what's happening in Beijing?
Yeah, it's been really exciting. I actually have been running a summer training clinic for my swim team, the Water Dragons, and a lot of the children have been, like, really excited about not wanting to train because we work out late and we're usually in the pool till like 9-10 o'clock at night sometimes. And a couple of nights ago when they had the 4x100, they were like, we got to get there to see, you know, Phelps and the crew. And it happens to be that one of the swimmers that was in there, that's an African-American, they met him down in North Carolina at this National Black Heritage Swim Meet. And they said, wow, they're going to do this and it's going to happen. They got the gold medal. It was a really big deal, you know.
And ladies, so did you see that when, like, which has been your favorite race to watch, Tamika?
Swimming.
But what kind of the swimming? Is it exciting when the U.S. wins, or does it matter who wins?
It's really exciting when the U.S. wins.
And Kayra?
I just like...
You just like everything about it, ladies, right?
Yeah.
I want to thank you both for being with us today. That's Tamika Lewis. She's 9 years old. And Kayra Lenore, age 8, both aspire to be members of an Olympic swim team one day. And we also have swim coach Offit Porter, who coaches the Water Dragons at the YMCA in Mount Vernon. Thank all of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lim.
Are you okay? There you go.
Here we
you
go.
You feel better?
I do.
Excellent.
Thanks, babe. I'm Catherine Lanford. Let's turn to Femi Okay with the news.
Thank you very much. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour, President Bush spoke recently at the White House. He says that the U.S. won't cast aside the embattled Republic of Georgia. On the ground in Georgia today, Russian troops are still in control of the central city of Gori, and Georgian officials say that Russian tanks are deep inside the Georgian territory. Canada is the latest country to cancel a joint military exercise with Russia to protest its military action in Georgia. A top Russian general says that Poland's recent missile defense shield deal with the U.S. won't go unpunished. And it's Independence Day in India, and hundreds of thousands of security personnel are deployed around the country to watch for signs of further bomb attacks after several blasts in the most recent weeks. Let's look at some of the stories making your headlines this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi. And Femi told us a little bit earlier this week about the U.S. Census Bureau numbers are showing that by 2042 that minorities, blacks, Latinos, Asians, will actually be in the majority, which is much faster than they had anticipated.
8 years faster than
people thought. 8 years faster. So that got us to thinking about what will the country look like then? What will the country be acting like? And how will this change affect who we are as Americans? Pulitzer Prize winner Dale Maharaj has a few ideas on this. He's the author of The Coming White Majority and other books focused on cultural change. He's been looking at this for a real long time. Good morning, Dale. And you're coming to us from your home state of California, which is already living this idea of minorities as the new majority, right?
Yes, in 1998, California passed the threshold into white minority, and the state's about 45% minority, white now, and the rest 55% minority.
So what does that tell us about what the country, the rest of the country is in for?
Well, like so much of the rest of the other issues, California is leading the nation in this area. I saw the change coming in 1991 after the L.A. riots. I came back to California from New York City where I was teaching, and I spent 9 years on this book. I looked at the change through four different families in California. And, of course, some of your listeners may remember there was a backlash against non-whites in the 1990s. There were a series of initiatives against immigrants, bilingual education, and affirmative action. I called it a white electoral riot at the ballot box. And it's a different state now. That was sort of the last gasp of people who were afraid of this change. The state is now, as I said, 45% white. It's amazingly much more multicultural. Among younger people who've grown up with different cultures, there's a whole lot more acceptance. And after that 9 years of research, I concluded the book by saying basically that so much is working in California. We hear when things don't work, but so much is working. And as I've noted, people are voting with their feet down the marriage aisle. And when I finished the book in 1999, there were, when it came out in the 2000 edition, there were 20% of all births were interracial. So people are dating, they're marrying, they're working together. Every day things work in California. It's not the apocalypse.
And let's get to that notion of the apocalypse. You say that media coverage talks about this demographic change in a very shallow manner. What are we missing in the media?
Well, I always tell my students, go out and talk to real people. There was a study done during the anti-bilingual ballot initiative. 186 stories in the major California papers, only two stories actually went into a bilingual classroom. You should stop talking to pundits like me and go out and talk to people. And you'll find that, you know, that's where you find the truth of all what's going on, not in talking heads inside the Beltway.
This is Catherine Lanford. Dale, go back for a minute. We were talking about that last gasp of sort of white fright. What does that portend then for when the nation as a whole reaches a minority majority? How much of that will we see again?
Well, I was curious. My latest book is called Dennis in Iowa. It's a rather silly title for a very important book about cultural change in the heartland. I went and lived in a small Iowa town, Dennis in Iowa, for 1 year. It was 8,000 residents. About one-third of them were Latino. 10 years before, there were no Latinos in that town. And I documented that cultural change on a very small scale in a place where they're not used to it. And you know what? It was a microcosm of California. A lot was working. There was frictions, of course. There was racism, yes. But all in all, there was incredible acceptance.
And what do you attribute that to?
Look, I think when you get close to quote-unquote other, you realize we all want the same things. We want good schools. We want jobs. The racial barrier, I don't know, your listeners who work with other races in an office, you have to be hard-pressed. Like if you ask me who my co-workers, what their races are, I don't think of them that way anymore. It becomes second nature when you're close to other people. So in places like Vermont, where you know it's tremendously still white, and parts of the South are just in the black-white dynamic still, it seems bizarre and foreign and scary. And I understand why people are scared. You know, it's new and it's different. When I moved to California in 1980, I was moving into the polyglot, and I wasn't sure what to expect. So it's not unheard of, but I think as people live it, they realize we're just people.
Dale, we have John Zogby standing by. He is the pollster and the author of The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. He's joining us from Utica, New York. John, you have come up with these new populations, these four different archetypes for the American population. Given this discussion we're having on the new census figures, we're going to have a large number of elderly. We're going to have a minority majority. How given this conversation we're just having, how do you see your population types intersecting here?
Well, interestingly, that generation of elderly that we're talking about in 2040, 2050 or so are in many instances going to be today's first globals, today's 18 to 29-year-olds who are already accustomed to living in a diverse world in their communities, from their schools, and on their planet. And so they will bring that more cosmopolitan and accepting worldview into their old age. Subsequent groups that come up are only going to be living in a more diverse world, and diversity, multiculturalism actually works. Now, for those who...
And do you say that, John, based on your experience of these decades worth of surveying?
Oh, absolutely. The numbers when it comes to attitudes and, more importantly, behaviors... you know, the previous guest talked about walking with their feet, walking down the marriage aisle. 18 to 29-year-olds don't consider Barack Obama to be an African-American candidate for president. They consider him to be a candidate for president because he's like their school principal. He's like their supervisor at work. He is like their neighbor. They live and work in a much more diverse setting than previous age cohorts did.
And so, Dale, when we take a look, obviously it's impossible to predict the future. And there's also been some real discussion about how we define the various categories of race. For example, who is white? Who is Latino? Who is African American? Does any of that matter in terms of what the picture will look like and how we'll be treating one another?
On a human level, no. But on a political level, yes. At the turn of last century, in the early 1900s, Italians and Eastern European Jewish people were considered other and non-white, and they were folded into white as the century progressed. There's some who feel that Latino may get folded in the same way. I beg to differ. It's a different age. You don't have to, you can have your separate and still be part of the larger culture. There's a model I use in my book. It's like the Olympic rings where they intersect. That's the common ground where we all live, and we all go off into our little corners of whatever we, you know, define ourselves as a subset. But we're all in the same center area in the public sphere. And so politically, though, the numbers are very important. Some, both on the left and right, for very, very different reasons, don't want to count race anymore. And I think it's very important that we have these categories until we do have an egalitarian society.
Egalitarian society. Dale, thanks so much. Dale Maharaj is the author of The Coming White Minority and other books that deals with cultural and demographic issues in America. And John Zogby, thank you too. John is a pollster and author of The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, reminding you that I am in for John Hockenberry, and we are always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend feed, Twitter.
And we are going to continue to follow this story about the demographic change here in the United States. By 2042, minorities will be the new majority. What's your thought on that? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or drop us a note at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, as I said, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The news that Julia Child was a spy during World War II got us to thinking, what if Rachel Ray was intercepting phone calls from Al-Qaeda?
And then you sprinkle the whole thing with some dill and a little parsley. And this, my friends, is what's for dinner.
Or how about, I don't know, A-Rod running covert ops in Afghanistan? Antonin Scalia deciphering code. Call it a new recipe for old espionage. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, August 15th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Adora.
Coming up, what power does America have to help solve the world's problems today, particularly in Russia, in the dispute between Russia and Georgia? We'll check in with our man, Ollie Williams, covering the Olympics for the BBC. And how good can bad pros get? We'll ask you and an editor from HarperCollins. But first, these headlines.
Less than an hour ago, in remarks made at the Rose Garden, President Bush said he wants Russian troops out of the Republic of Georgia.
The people of Georgia have cast their lot with a free world, and we will not cast them aside.
A Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, has already responded. He says Georgia's two breakaway provinces that started this conflict are unlikely to ever be part of Georgia again, and Russia will support the separatists. Russia is already moving to bring the breakaway province of South Ossetia under its control and is setting up a cell phone network in the region and will start broadcasting Russian TV there. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, to discuss a new ceasefire proposal for Georgia and Russia. She says even though the agreement will allow Russian troops to stay in Georgia, it's in Georgia's best interest.
And the U.S. has taken one of its own stands, closing a deal for a missile defense system to be placed in Poland. This is a deal that Russia has vehemently opposed. Today, the Kremlin says such a move will not go unpunished. India celebrates 61 years of independence today, and the Prime Minister has some words of warning for Pakistan, saying the peace process is in jeopardy because of Pakistan's rumored involvement. You may remember this, Catherine, in last month's bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. Pakistan's intelligence service is said to be supporting pro-Taliban militants.
And this in, Adora, Pakistan facing its own instability. President Pervez Musharraf may resign in the next few days rather than face impeachment. Three of Pakistan's four assemblies have called on Musharraf to step down. Little Olympic news. Michael Phelps has racked up his, count 'em, six gold medal in Beijing, but Phelps is not resting on his laurels.
My goal of raising the bar in the sport of swimming, I think, is coming along nicely. But, you know, I think it's still going to take time for me to really get it to where I want it to be.
Phelps is one gold medal away from tying Mark Spitz's record of seven.
American Airlines is facing $7 million in fines for safety violations. The FAA says the airline flew planes it knew needed repairs and did not properly test employees for drugs and alcohol.
America is changing. By 2042, minorities, the new majority. Tell us about your neighborhood at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mail us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. President Bush accused Russia of bullying and intimidation against Georgia, saying that the people in the former Soviet Republic chose freedom and that, quote, we will not cast them aside, end quote. These are statements that he made earlier this morning on the White House grounds as he's on his way to go back to his Texas ranch. We are going to talk about some more words that were exchanged today. We're waiting to hear from Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who'll be speaking soon in the Republic of Georgia. And just not that long ago, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev and German Chancellor Angela Merkel spoke after their own talks. And we're going to go now to London, where Jonathan Marcus, one of the diplomatic correspondents at our world partner, the BBC, is going to tell us what they said. Jonathan?
Well, I think quite uncompromising words from the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, making it crystal clear that in his view, and the Russians have said this before, Georgia and South Ossetia, the two separatist enclaves in Georgia, are not going to go back to Georgian control anytime soon. The Russians clearly are sticking to that point. Interestingly, alongside him, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, made it clear that the territorial integrity of Georgia was, as she put it, a basic point in any peace plan, very much echoing the American president's words. So clearly a standoff there. Russian President Mr. Medvedev also making it clear that the recently signed deal between Poland and the United States on missile defenses was, as he put it, a decision that was clearly aimed against the Russian Federation.
You know, with these latest comments with the Chancellor of Germany siding with President Bush, it almost feels as if there are seams opening up all over Europe.
Well, there are seams opening up. I think in the broad sense that the Europeans abhor what the Russians have done and support, obviously, the territorial integrity of Georgia, and they clearly support, as Angela Merkel stressed again today, Georgia's aspiration to join NATO. I think there are still very great divisions within Europe on exactly what should be done, both in the short term, just to get the Russians out of Georgia, but also in the longer term, what this really means for relations between Russia and the West. And I think we've seen some of those tensions already at the meeting of European Union foreign ministers the other day. There'll be a meeting of NATO foreign ministers next week, Tuesday, in Brussels. I think we're going to see some differences there as well. But of course, on the basic point that the Russians need to get out of Georgia and shouldn't be behaving in this way, there is clearly unanimity.
You mentioned the U.S. Polish missile deal, to putting the U.S. missile base, the battery, in Poland. Just earlier this morning, there was a senior Russian defense official who said that this act cannot go unpunished. The phrase saber-rattling comes to mind, but this rhetoric keeps ratcheting up.
Well, the rhetoric is ratcheting up. I think part of the problem is that clearly the Russians are strongly in position on the ground in Georgia. There isn't much that's going to shift them until they decide to pull back their forces. So the options open to the Americans and to the wider Western community, the Europeans and NATO, are relatively limited. Now, I think we've seen one step by the U.S. president. I mean, clearly he sent Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, to Tbilisi, where she is now, the Georgian capital. Very noticeably, she hasn't gone to Moscow. We've seen the American aid flights of humanitarian aid into Georgia. Very strong rhetorical statements. Now the signing of this deal with Poland on missile defense. So it doesn't look as though the Bush administration's policy towards Russia is going to necessarily change change in a way that the Russians would like to see. I think what this whole affair is going to do, it's going to push Russia and relations with Moscow much higher up the foreign policy agenda in the presidential race. It's relations with Moscow are going to be a key problem for the next U.S. president, whichever of the contenders wins the White House.
You know, we are so focused on what's happening right there on the ground, but if you, because of your work as a diplomatic correspondent, elsewhere in the world, how does this make them apprehensive? What are their observations? China, Pakistan, India, certainly they have a stake in all of this.
Well, it's paradoxical in a way, because, I mean, countries like China, for example, and generally speaking, Russia, are very strong supporters of national sovereignty. They don't like it when the West says, look, we perhaps ought to intervene here. We ought to bring pressure to bear on governments about what they're doing inside their own countries, because the Russians, the Chinese and others are always very strong supporters of national sovereignty. Now, in the case of Georgia, this is clearly not Russia's position. Russia, no doubt, would argue that it is merely following on from the West's example in Kosovo, when the West backed Kosovo's independence, allowed it to secede from Serbia, something at the time which the Russians warned would have consequences. So I think think, you know, when the Russians make these warnings, they're serious. It's not just empty words. I think they have limitations. They can do this sort of thing in their near abroad, as they call it, in what you guys, I suppose, would call Russia's backyard. What they can do more broadly is very hard to see.
All right, Jonathan, it's always delightful to hear a diplomatic correspondent for the BBC use the phrase, you guys. Thank you so much.
We all speak the same language. Thank you.
Yeah, all right. That Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC News, one of our partners. And, of course, Adora, we're going to keep following this story.
We are. Now we're going to take a look at a story that has perhaps been overshadowed by the crisis in Georgia and all the attention that the Olympics has been getting in Beijing. And that's the full story happening in the Philippines this week. Violence there erupted between government forces and a militant Islamic group in the southern province of North Cotabato following a Supreme Court ruling which has blocked plans for the militants to expand their territory. The government says the militants refused to leave the province, and so it ordered military strikes, airstrikes, leaving 160,000 people with nowhere to go, at least for some period of time. We're going to turn to Michael Barker, a correspondent in Manila with our partner, the BBC, for the latest. Michael, can you explain what's happening today?
Well, the fighting's ceased, and we've had most of the people who fled the area where the conflict was going on return home. Although I do understand from the World Food Program, there's still about 16,000 families, in fact, who are continue to be afraid of actually returning to their homes. So they're still in evacuation shelters. But certainly the large numbers, estimated as high as 160,000 civilians, most have returned home, and some order, some degree of calm has returned to the area.
And how would you describe the militant group that rules? Do they rule? Do they have autonomy in this southern province?
Well, that's what they're seeking. That's basically the crux of this whole issue in Mindanao in the southern Philippines. There's a desire by the separatist group known as the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. They've been waging a struggle for almost 40 years now for a separate state. They believe they were very close with this draft agreement that was struck between negotiators of their group and that of the government. This was agreed a few weeks ago. A spanner was thrown in the works when the Supreme Court here prevented a formal signing. The essence of this group is that claim that historically the Bangsamoro Moro people, who are primarily Muslim, have claim to this part of the country. They've had that their land and their resources stripped away down hundreds of years of colonization by the Spanish and then the Americans. And they are continuing to this day to try and establish a formal degree of a state that would be largely autonomous, give them control of their resources, essentially allow them to set up a federal-type state. Government, many politicians are very much against it. They claim it's in breach of the Constitution and would create an independent state within a state.
Finally, what's the next step here? Do you know, quickly?
As we speak, there've been hearings in the Supreme Court today to determine whether or not this original order is going to continue, which is freezing the deal, or whether they will hear arguments and lift that order. My understanding is that at the moment, the freeze order on this agreement being formally signed is still in place. There will be further hearings.
So we'll be watching for those further hearings. Michael Barker, thank you. Michael Barker is the BBC correspondent in Manila, bringing us up to date to what's happening there. And today we're asking you, who's moving into your neighborhood, into your schools, into your workplace, with this notion of a changing demographic in the United States and of America, where minorities will be the majority by 2042. Have you seen signs of this? Do you believe it? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, August 15th, and we've been looking at the changing face of America with new numbers showing that American minorities, blacks, Latinos, Asians, will become the majority by 2042. And we talked with pollster John Zogby about this, and he, some of you had some thoughts too.
John, Massachusetts, Mr. Zogby is absolutely correct. And if America prepares correctly from an economic standpoint, the coming transition in demographics will signal an incredible international economic boom and domestic on our part. Because now not only we will be reaching out to the rest of the world even more and not be so, let's just say, United States-centric.
Many thanks for that. And what's your take? You can call in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Catherine?
Swimmer Michael Phelps is up to 6 gold medals with 6 new world records at the Olympics in Beijing. Okay, Adora, this is the moment where you sort of yawn with fatigue.
We've been hearing a lot about Michael Phelps, but boy, has he really done something admirable.
Well, he has. His latest win was in the 200-meter individual medley. Next up is the 100-meter butterfly final. But before all of that, it's time for us to check in with our own Ollie Williams and our own Olympics correspondent. His day job is blogging about the games for our partner at the BBC World Service, but we think of Ollie as our own. Good morning, dear.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, we already have Phelps fatigue. I mean, I wish the man well, but come on. How exciting, but I know you want to tell me, how exciting was his win today?
That's a little harsh. If you have Phelps fatigue, imagine how he feels. I imagine he's pretty fatigued. Have you won 6 gold medals recently?
Well, not this summer.
Well, oh, sorry. Of course, I forgot Athens, of course, where you famously came back in the 400-meter freestyle. I remember that well.
It's Catherine defending champion Lanfer. Yes, yes.
So it is.
I am nothing compared to Michael Phelps. Tell me what his win was like today.
Well, let's... like every other win. I mean, the man is just a phenomenon. You run out of superlatives after a while to describe the way that every single result goes for him. I mean, just looking at every single race that's been going on since this Olympics started, which Phelps has been in, you might as well only have Phelps in it. I can't remember who took silver. I can't really remember who took bronze. Every race, it's a race between Phelps and the world record line, which they now superimpose on the pool. You see this green line tick forwards. That shows you the world record. It's a race between that and Phelps. It's just him against himself. It's phenomenal.
Wow. Oh, now, the games aren't over, but I heard there's already an Olympic auction. And, you know, I want to buy Adora a little tchotchke, something to commemorate our week together here. So what's up for sale? She's already looking at me like, please, no.
Yeah, give me an idea of budget here, because have you got maybe, I don't know, $10,000 to spend on Adora?
Well, what can I get for 10, huh?
Well, you have a $10,000. Okay, you can get a number of Olympic torches. The real things, that's what you can get, including those used at the 1936 Berlin Olympics and at Mexico City 1968. Should explain, this auction is going on in Beijing alongside the games itself. $10,000 plus each is the going rate for them. I personally think that's a bargain.
Adora, do you want two?
They're really for sale? Ollie, where have they been all this time? If you're talking about the 1936 torch...
It's an excellent question. They have resurfaced in Beijing, wherever they have been all this time. They've resurfaced alongside some bizarre little trinkets at the same time. We have everything from the official cuddly toy mascot of the 1980 Lake Placid Winter Olympics,
and
Ronnie the Raccoon.
And who wouldn't want that? What is the name? I'm sorry.
Ronnie the Raccoon.
I know you just wanted to say that. Who wouldn't want Ronnie the Raccoon? Who would buy it?
Well, why not get that in a bundle with Waldy the Dachshund, who was the mascot for Munich 1972? And if you've never seen Waldy, go and have a look at Waldy on the internet, because it's the least inspiring mascot you've ever seen for anything ever. There was a beaver as well. The beaver was a mascot for one of the Olympic Games, which looks like a table tennis bat cover with a sash. Truly, Olympic mascots are a joy to behold. Now, $2 million will get you a bracelet made of jade rings in the five Olympic colours. $2 million for one of those.
Wow. Now, that actually sounds like something I'd wear.
And most bizarrely, really, I'm not too sure I'd have gone down that road myself, but if you've got $2 million, all yours. Bizarrely, the final thing that I picked out of the list, a badge from the LAPD and California Highway Patrol from the time of the 1984 LA Games. I can't entirely work out where... I think that's a tenuous Olympic reference at best. But a badge from the LAPD does exist here, plus a perfume bottle from Atlanta 96.
Oh, my goodness. All right, let's get back to some more game-centric. Well, in fact, you know, whenever we talk about the Olympic Games, it only seems fair to talk about the weather. So talk to me. Have there been any storms lately?
I think it's fair to say there's been nothing but storms over the last few days. Heavy storms across Beijing in the last couple of days affecting the rowing, the sailing, the tennis. I saw about an hour ago play was suspended in the football between the US and Canada for the same reason. Soccer to Americans, sorry.
Thank
bit of British
you.
Sneaking in there.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly affected was the British canoeist David Florence. Won a silver medal earlier in the week. Took his parents to see the Great Wall of China afterwards, only to see them both nearly get struck by lightning. They both needed treatment after a lightning blast hit a nearby tree. We understand they're okay now. Amazingly, the beach volleyball players carried on throughout all of this. Thunder, lightning, downpours, they don't mind. Clearly, beach weather. The shooters are in trouble, though, because the rain steamed up their glasses, which they wear to improve their vision, so they couldn't see properly.
Wow. So what else is going on, Ollie?
Okay, well... A brilliant story came out a couple of days ago about Ma Junren, who was a famous Chinese coach, famed for a photo which showed him chain-smoking on a motorbike while guiding a troop of Chinese athletes on a sort of daily, grueling marathon training session up at high altitude a couple of decades ago. He's a hard man of coaching, achieved brilliant successes, especially in Atlanta 96. One of his athletes, Wang Junjia, won the women's 5,000 meters gold, bearing in mind that China's record in athletics is usually pretty shocking. Later embroiled in a doping scandal, nothing was ever proved about this. He insisted all along he'd been giving his athletes a cocktail of caterpillar fungus and turtle blood, nothing more.
Okay, you know what? Caterpillar fungus is where we're going to have to cut you off, Ollie. You
really?
Obviously need a little more rest,
well,
and then we're going to come back.
I'll just quickly finish. I'll tell you, Ma Junren now breeds Tibetan mastiffs instead.
Okay, Ollie, thank you. Our friend Ollie Williams, blogging about the Olympics for our partner, the BBC World Service. Now we turn to one of our other lovely partners, Femi Oke, with the news.
Thank you very much. It is 29 minutes past the hour. Here are some of the stories in making news this morning. President Bush is warning Russia against, and I quote, bullying and intimidation. Mr. Bush told Russia to leave Georgian territory, and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev responded immediately, saying he doesn't think that Georgia's two breakaway provinces will ever be part of Georgia again. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in the Georgian capital Tbilisi, trying to talk officials there into signing on to a new ceasefire. The Kremlin says a controversial deal between the US and Poland, finalized today, is not going to go unpunished. The deal allows the US to put a missile defense system on Polish soil. That's the latest from Russia, Georgia,
thanks,
and
ma'am.
The US.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. New census numbers are out showing America's minorities will become the majority by 2042. And we want to know how you are seeing this change in your own neighborhood.
Hi, my name is Deborah, and I live in Queens, New York, the most diverse county in the country. So I'm used to seeing people from lots of different places and hearing lots of different languages. But I've noticed on my road trips around the country that the South Asian, Indian, Pakistani population is really spreading in America and bringing their history and culture to places that haven't seen much diversity.
Okay, now share your take. What are you seeing out there? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Adora?
That was very interesting. Now we're going to move on to a story that's just been developing rapidly in the past week and even today. A little over an hour ago, President Bush accused Russia of bullying and intimidating Georgia, saying that the people in the former Soviet Republic chose freedom, and Bush said that the United States will not cast them aside. And this comes just as Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice landed in Georgia today with hopes of helping to resolve the crisis. But how much can Bush and Rice accomplish? The entire situation has triggered lots of questions about the power and influence of the United States. And with some thoughts on that, we have Dr. Gregory Hall, who is the chair of Morehouse College's Political Science Department, and also currently working on a book about the energy politics in the Caspian Sea. Good morning, Dr. Hall. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, Dr. Hall, a lot of tough language between Russian and U.S. officials this week. What do you make of it?
Well, this crisis shows that there are many unresolved issues from the Cold War and even before, and the frustrations from the Russian side about having lost geopolitical position after the Cold War, and frustrations from the American side having very few options to deal with the situation.
Well, let's start with Russia. Explain some of those frustrations, because a lot has changed there in the past decade when the economy was tough and things in general were very tough both domestically and internationally for Russia.
Certainly. It's been quite a change in Russia and in the Russian outlook since the early and mid-1990s. But during that time, essentially many Russians have perceived that the West has essentially been encroaching or encircling Russia, a sort of new containment to bring new friends into the Western orbit, but to kind of keep the Russians in check. I think that the icing on the cake for the Russians recently has been the granting of independence to Kosovo. I think that's a bit understated, particularly in the Western press, that the Russians are really, really agitated over Kosovo basically being wrestled from Serbia. And, of course, the plan for missile shield emplacements in Poland and the Czech Republic further aggravate the Russians. So they, in the Russian mindset, the West is working in a very determined way to, if you will, encircle Russia after the Cold War.
Well, Dr. Hall, would you call the timing of Russia's assertiveness, aggressiveness, as some would describe it, in the Georgian situation, would that be a calculated move, do you think, to reassert its dominance in the region?
I believe so. I believe the Russians see this as a great opportunity. I think the first main objective for Russian leaders in this current episode, which many argue was precipitated by Georgian leaders, was to essentially remove a Georgian military presence or influence in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. But I think the bonus for Russian leaders has been to use the situation to make Georgia unfit for NATO membership. And I think that's the real Russian strategic objective in this current episode.
Well, let's go back to then how that affects the United States and its relevance as a mediator of a country of influence in the region, because the U.S. is really not in the position to do much, so many have told us.
Yeah, no, we don't have much leverage in this situation. Of course, there are calls to limit Russian
cooperation in the G8. There could be some targeted sanctions that have more economic impact for Russian firms. But no, we don't have much in the way of leverage in this particular situation. And part of that is that there are implications for the flow of energy supplies into the Caucasus, on into the EU countries.
So in terms of U.S. influence and the dynamic between the United States and Russia, if you say that the U.S. has very little leverage over Russia, then how does that leave the U.S. standing in the world as a superpower?
Well, I think that the transition to what some call a multipolar world, or at least to a world where you have the U.S. as the first among equals, but a power that out of necessity must consult and coordinate policy more with rising regional actors, that day is here. And I think more of our own leaders have to recognize that politics in that way has to adjust, and diplomacy has to adjust. It's just a different time that we live in.
A different time that we live in. It sounds like a takeaway to me. Many thanks to you, Dr. Gregory Hall. Dr. Gregory Hall is chair of the Political Science Department at Morehouse College in Atlanta. He's currently working on a book about energy politics in the Caspian Sea. And now we turn to Femi Oke with some headlines at this hour. Femi?
Thanks, Adore. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the hour, one main story dominating the news this morning. Let me bring you some further developments in the crisis in Georgia. Condoleezza Rice arrived in the capital, Tbilisi, this morning, armed with a new ceasefire agreement. The United States is urging Georgia to accept the plan, which would allow Russia to keep some troops in the breakaway region South Ossetia. But just last hour, President Bush spoke from the White House, and he had some strong words for Moscow. He accused Russia of bullying and intimidation and said the Kremlin must respect Georgian sovereignty.
The United States and our allies stand with the people of Georgia and their democratically elected government.
Meanwhile, on the ground in Georgia today, Russian troops continue to occupy positions deep inside the country. In the main port city of Poti, Russian forces have been taken control of the naval dockyard and appear to have destroyed at least six Georgian naval vessels. And in some good economic news for a change, the Federal Reserve says that the industrial output rose in July by 0.2%. That's slightly better than expected, but, and this is unfortunately some bad news, it was only half of the gains in June. And that's a look at your main big news story of the day.
Thanks, Ben.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's August 15th. It's a Friday, and I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And you're in for John Hockenberry, right?
Yeah. Oh, man.
And I'm Adore You. I'm Adore You, Doji. And come on, Catherine. We've all seen the movies, the James Bond movies, the Bourne Identity movies. We're talking about spy thrillers,
yeah,
books and movies. And we have a sense. We know what being a spy is all about, right?
Well, sure. First of all, I got to get the right outfit.
You got to get the right outfit. Well, that might be a thought, actually, because this week there have been nearly a million newly released declassified documents about personal details about Americans who actually worked for the OSS, which was the precursor for the CIA.
And now those were the days to be a spy.
That was, yeah, many decades ago, and that included Chef Julia Child, among others, Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, who were actually spying for the government. Peter Ernest spent 35 years with the CIA. He really knows about spies.
Okay.
Before becoming the executive director of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. I'm delighted to be with you.
So these new documents really shed a little light into what it was, what it meant to be a, a spy for the OSS. What do we learn from them?
Oh, I think we learn a lot of things. It's a wonderful treasure, if you will, to release to the public at this time. I was at the CIA and signed off on the first release we made of OSS records, and they were pretty dry, I'll tell you. They were logistics and supply matters and so forth. But here you're now seeing in great detail the stories of men and women who were moved to help their country at the risk of their lives in some cases. That is, they were in the front lines, often behind enemy lines, which means way ahead of front lines. And many of these people went on to become great contributors to American society in different ways, such as Arthur Goldberg. So what this reflects is...
Who was a Supreme Court Justice, right.
...is the passion of people moved at that time. And this is during World War II.
But, Peter, we want to know the details. Like, what kinds of things were they doing? Were they acting as covert agents? Were they...
Who did Julia Child kill? Let's just cut to the chase.
Okay. If you want to cut to the chase, then the best thing to do is read the files, because in many cases what they're releasing is the operational details of people like, say, Sterling Hayden, the actor, who was basically, he loved the sea, but when war came, he joined the Marine Corps and the OSS under an assumed name. And he actually was smuggling things into the people resisting German occupation in both Croatia, as well as primarily in Croatia and along the coast. So this was a person who went behind enemy lines. He was attacked by the Germans, and yet later he was an actor. He was in The Godfather. He was in Dr. Strangelove. So this is what's amazing about this release is you do have the operational details. You don't have to go to people like me to get it.
You said that this was a really good time for them to be released. What do you mean?
Well, I think it's a time when, you know, we have had so many questions about our government and our country in the wake of Vietnam, Watergate, even the Iraq War. So there's questioning, I think, amongst the American people about many things. And I think this reminds us of a period when there weren't those kinds of questions, when people unhesitatingly volunteered their services in any way they could be used to help the country in its war effort.
So we're talking about a window into the past. Peter Ernest, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Peter Ernest, the executive director of the International Spy Museum, talking about the thousands of newly released declassified documents.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. New numbers are out showing that America's minorities will become the majority by 2042, some years earlier than we thought. We're asking you how you're seeing this change in your own neighborhood.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota, and I live in an area of the United States that is of predominantly Northern European ancestry, high percentages of German and Scandinavian people. But recent additions to my neighborhood, my block, include people of Asian ancestry as well as a Filipino family, and it's my belief that heaven will be a rainbow of ethnicities. And so it may be incredibly cliche to oversimplify this way, but a more diverse neighborhood is a little bit of heaven on earth.
Oh,
thanks so much, Troy.
We like
Troy.
Yeah, and we want to hear what you have to say as well. So share your take. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're going to turn now to Femi. Okay, our little bit of heaven with the news.
Does Troy have a job? Or is it listening to The Takeaway all the time? Good morning, Troy. Hope you're well.
We like Troy.
Yes, we love him. 11 minutes to the hour, the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev says that Georgia's two separatist regions probably won't ever be part of Georgia again. Russian troops continue to block the eastern road into the key city of Gori. A top Russian general says that Poland's recent missile defense shield deal with the US, and I quote, won't go unpunished. Some economic numbers just out this morning, and they're good ones. The government says that industrial output squeaked up by 0.2% last month. That's not much, but it's better than the analysts predicted. And finally, there's a computer graphics and interactive technology conference in Los Angeles, and it's showcasing the robotics of the future. One of the latest innovations is a robot with social skills and facial expressions.
Hello, my name is Nixie. I can tell you that I'm sad, mad, confused, excited, or even bored just by moving my face.
But how about crazy Nixie? If you actually look at Nixie, she's actually very, very scary. You know those robots in the scary horror movies? But it's good that robots can do these things.
They've come a long way, I got to tell you. That sounds a lot more realistic than the one that used to just, my name is Joe.
And don't you think my skin here, my skin cover, it's doing really well, considering how old I am for a robot?
I knew it!
We're going to move on to some books, which I know both of you love.
All right, Femi, thanks.
This is for all the book lovers out there.
Great,
no
thanks.
Doubt you've heard this line. I know you've all heard it. It was a dark and stormy night.
Oh, yes.
Very famous. But you know who wrote it?
No.
Yes, you do, Catherine. It was a rhetorical question. That would be Victorian.
She's just joining in.
Edward Hallward Lytton in his 1830 book, Paul Clifford. You knew who that was, didn't you?
I knew.
We know you know. And in his honor, the English department at San Jose State University holds a contest every year for the last 26 years asking people to submit their very worst, best opening lines. In a twist, we've invited HarperCollins editor Dawn Davis to write along with us to get her perspective. Welcome, Dawn. What's the ingredients? What goes into the best, worst opening line of a book?
Well, overwriting, too many adjectives, and not enough kind of intrigue about what happens next.
And I should tell folks that you know what you're talking about as a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor of books, and she came out with that list very quickly, Catherine.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to take it down. Overwriting, check. What was the next one?
Well, basically, not enough mystery, and the characters aren't intriguing enough. You haven't set it up so that we want to keep going.
All right.
But overriding is the worst.
Okay, well, let's take a look at, or a listen, rather, as I read one of the entries. Here we go, Dawn. The hardened detective glanced at his rookie partner and mused that whoever had coined the term white as a sheet had never envisioned a bed accessorized with a set of hazelnut 500-count Egyptian cotton linens from Ralph Lauren.
Now, one of the things I think I said earlier on was too many adjectives. There's too much going on in that sentence. There's a lot of overriding. She kind of lost me at accessorized. I was trying to hang on there, and then once we got into what the bed sheets were accessorized with, I knew we were in trouble.
All right. Let's try this one then. And think more like The Hobbit. This is the direction we're going in. Toads of glory, slugs of joy, sang Groin the dwarf as he trotted jovially down the path before a great dragon ate him, because the author knew that the story was a train wreck after he typed the first few words.
Well, it sounds like the author indeed.
I mean, Toads of glory.
Come on, you've heard stuff worse than this.
No, I think
maybe.
Toads of Glory got her.
All right, here's one last one, and then we're going to get to the person who actually won. Like a mechanic who forgets to wipe his hands on a shop rag and then goes home, hugs his wife, and gets a grease stain on her favorite sweater, love touches you and marks you forever. Dawn?
See, I thought that one was pretty good until we got to love hugs you and gets you forever. She's mixing metaphors, and it wasn't working for me.
Okay, now you're a harsh one. Why don't we actually listen to the person, the man who actually won this contest? And mind you, Dawn, there were hundreds of entries. Listen.
Hello, this is Garrison Speak, the winner of the 2008 Bulwer Lytton Fiction Contest. I'm calling from Washington, D.C., and here is my award-winning sentence. Theirs was a New York love. A checkered taxi ride burning rubber. And like the city, their passion was open 24/7, steam rising from their bodies like slick streets, exhaling warm, moist, white breath through manhole covers stamped, forged by Delaney Brothers, Piscataway, New Jersey. Awful, ain't it?
You have to like him for the awful, don't you?
So, Donna, what do you think about that?
You know, I think I've heard worse. I don't think it's the worst thing I've ever heard. It's a little overdone. What I might do with something like that is write it, sit with it for a while, and then go back with a pencil and take out maybe a third of what's going on there.
So let's talk about what you think does make a good book. Like, what is it when you get, how many manuscripts do you get a week, a month, or a year even?
Well, we probably get 40 solicited submissions a month. And then I would say, you know, kind of who knows how many, because there's no bar for writing. One can take out a word processor and say, I'm a writer, and then send it to a publisher. So we get hundreds of unsolicited manuscripts a year.
And so when you pick up a book and start reading it, I mean, what does it look like that will force you to put the book down very quickly?
Well, we're looking for a reason to put the submission down because there's just so many of them. And what keeps me going is kind of economics of language, a kind of, I want to say, smart use of language, but also beauty. I'm looking for beauty, and that doesn't mean everyone has to write like Morrison, but I am looking for a kind of rhythm in the language, a kind of lyricism. Something that keeps me going.
Oh, I think I have it for you. Listen to this one. Bill swore the affair had ended, but Louise knew he was lying after discovering Tupperware containers under the seat of his car, which were not the off-brand containers she bought to save money, but authentic, burpable, lidded Tupperware. And she knew he would see that woman again, because unlike the flimsy fake containers that should always be recycled responsibly, real Tupperware must be returned to its rightful owner.
Aha.
See? Doesn't that have everything that you wanted?
I'm going to go search my cabinets for Tupperware that may not be mine.
See? Marital tips and excellent literature.
Exactly.
What more could you ask for?
Not much.
Yeah, okay.
But it is a fun competition, wouldn't you say?
Oh, it's totally fun.
And the winner actually gets something, which is not only to get up to be on the takeaway, but they also, he got a prize of $250.
So Don won half the prize. She got to be on the takeaway.
She got to be.
Could Don,
well, yes, exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Don Davis, thank you. Thanks, Don.
Don
Davis is an editor at the book publisher HarperCollins, and we thank her for joining us today.
That's who she is. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry, reminding you that we are always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter.
And on today's show, we're following the latest from Georgia and Russia. We're also talking about how 2042 will be the year that minorities will become the new majority. Tell us what you see in your own neighborhood. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hey, also on our website, we talked to some young swimmers today. There is a fantastic video of our own Femme Oke speaking with young swimmers about the Michael Phelps effect.
And speaking of the Olympics, here's today's takeaway.
Took his parents to see the Great Wall of China afterwards, only to see them both nearly get struck by lightning.
Ollie Williams from the BBC reporting on the Olympics, always entertaining.
Next week, the takeaway is going on the road with Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein and web producer Adam Hirsch. You want to check in for that. Also, you want to make sure that you check in for anything you missed at thetakeaway.org. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
And like the city, their passion was open 24/7.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.